98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station. Weekly Blast.
It's never been about the numbers with DeAndre Ayton, but before last night, those numbers were starting to set off alarm bells. He had given up a 73% field goal percentage at the rim. He had an 8.5% turnover ratio on his touches in the paint, second worst in the league. His box outs per game ranked 41st, and don't even get me started on his lack of dunks. Sometimes I look at DeAndre Ayton, I wonder if Chris Paul and Devin Booker are still harping on him relentlessly or if they've had enough of that game. And then, just when I'm about to be done with this kid for good, you get a second half like last night. You get that powerful dunk on Paul's 10,000th assist, and you wonder once again how good this team could be if Ayton was more than just happy to be here. Now, it might seem unfair to some, judging another man's career based on what you think his inner fire should be, on how you think he should attack. But this is also professional sports, a league built on competition in a sport where flexing and aggressiveness and swagger are very important traits. And then, just when you're about to throw up your lunch and your hands for good, he has a stretch of play that dominates and lifts his team. Bottom line, God help the NBA if this guy ever gets it, and Lord help us if it never happens. All right, today's Bickley Blast brought to you by my friends at Chapman BMW. Test drive the ultimate driving machine at the newly renovated Chapman BMW in Chandler, at Chapman BMW on Camelback. You can find them online at chapmanbmw.com.
It really is like, it's just, it taunts you, doesn't it, when he has a half like that?
Mm-hmm.
Because here's the thing with Ayton, I think we can all agree that the biggest issue is consistency. So if you're looking at the landscape of the Western Conference with LeBron out right now and Anthony Davis out, and with all due respect to the Jazz, I think the Suns could certainly beat them in a seven-game series. I can't help but wonder, what if, even if Ayton can't pull this together consistently like throughout his career, what if he can pull it together consistently for a month and a half in the playoffs,
yeah,
what this team could do this year?
Mm-hmm. Think about that. And again, it's where people get sideways on this story, in my opinion, are the people who mistake development for effort. I understand that big men coming out of college into the NBA, it can take them longer. I understand that. I understand that in college, particularly at Arizona, not a lot of player development being had. It's the truth.
Not in March, that's for sure.
I would have really appreciated Sean Miller giving the Suns a heads up, but again, who knows how much time Sean Miller had with these kids and how much he really knew about the fire that DeAndre Ayton does not have. But it's just something that you can sit here and you can complain about it like I have 1,000 times. You can sit here and defend him like Vinny has done frequently and others have done frequently. I think what's interesting is to try to understand why it is that his mentality fluctuates in the matter of quarters.
Yeah.
You can see it in his gait. There are times when he jogs and there are times when he runs. And what makes him do one and what makes him not do the other?
I can't remember a lot of players recently that are as high profile as him that fluctuate so much from quarter to quarter or game to game. I mean, you could have a game where I had a great first quarter and then he kind of trailed off the rest of the game, but he consistently is inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
And to be as high profile as he is and to have halves like he did last night where you're like, yeah, this is what he can do.
Yeah.
I mean, to your point, it's not, he doesn't really have to develop his skills nearly as much.
No.
As he just needs to mentally be the same for the full 48 minutes.
That's what makes it so
frustrating.
Or at
least that's what it looks like, yes.
What makes it so frustrating.
And that's also the hardest thing when you're scouting someone, is because you see the athleticism, you see the size, you see the skills and the talent. Unless you watch, like, the reason that I was so critical is because I was such a hardcore U of A fan.
Mm-hmm.
And there's U of A fans or there's college basketball fans that can watch him and like, oh man, yeah, he put up, 20 and 10. He's a great player. And I'd be like, yeah, but if you watched him play every game, you see that he could do way more than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or that 20 and 10 didn't really impact the game.
You had the single, and I'm not saying this just to be nice on a Monday to you, Jared, but you had the single most accurate opinion about DeAndre Ayton of anybody going into his career in Phoenix, because I would dare say you saw him more than anybody. You saw probably almost every minute he ever played.
And I was probably frustrated with him more than most people were.
Your frustration showed through.
Because of that. And so I look at that, and that's the thing. What is it going to take to get this guy locked in?
Well, I think Chris Paul is a good start.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, because Luke pointed out earlier, is that the way the team is now composed, they have such great depth, and they now have two stars sort of ahead of DeAndre Ayton in the pecking order, is that when they're not as focused, they don't need him to develop into that superstar anymore necessarily.
Uh-huh.
Will that development now ever happen?
Well, it's my favorite thing about this team, because James Jones didn't draft DeAndre Ayton, and Monty Williams wasn't part of drafting him. And so they came in and they said, okay, we've got this piece that could potentially be great, but I'm not going to wait around for him.
Right.
We want to get this team back to the playoffs. We want to start winning games in the playoffs. And so they have found a way where, hey, look, on the nights DeAndre Ayton wants to catch up, we're going to be almost unbeatable. But we need to be more consistent than he is, and they are.
That's a great way of putting it. For a while, you could see this begin where Dario Saric was giving the team such quality minutes at the five. And keep in mind, Dario Saric has mostly played power forward in his career. Nobody ever looks at him and go, okay, that's a five, because he's not overly tall. He's slow afoot. He looks heavy legs sometimes. Yet he was having tremendous success closing out games at the five. And then I think what they realized is that will work sometimes, but it's not working in a seven-game series. It's not working against elite competition. It's not working against Anthony Davis.
And Sarge has come down to earth sort of the last few games
Right, and he's kind of come down to earth a little bit. So it's kind of re-sparked this idea that, yeah, we need the high end of DeAndre Ayton if we're really going to do this, if we're really going to get to the Western Conference Finals.
Here's a couple of cuts from last night. DeAndre Ayton talked about his success.
Do you really want to do this to me? These cuts, they just drive me insane. But go ahead, do it.
I love it.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you don't want to play to the level of the competition. You know, we still try to stick to our principles and do what we do best. And then, you know, we waited for the right mismatches, and we tried not to overforce things, but, you know, just still play in rhythm and still take advantage of it. And, you know, CP saw it early and got me going, him and Book. And, you know, it was just a flow from there.
What was different was in the second half, in the third quarter primarily, he was rising up and dunking the ball and running. He wasn't jogging. He wasn't trying to lay the ball in off the glass. And I don't know what it is. There are times when it looks like he just doesn't want to even be remotely physical.
He just doesn't have the edge. It's the edge.
It's an edge.
It's not like he's not trying. It's just you need to have that extra edge if you're going to take down Anthony Davis and the Lakers in the playoffs.
Without a doubt.
And Chris Paul knows this. And he will get him. Like, there was a couple of plays in the second half where, like you said, DeAndre Ayton was running. And one of the plays was the alley-oop. That was a beautiful one-handed slam it down in there. And the other play was he gave him like a bullet pass that he caught and put it in there. Chris Paul will find him if he's putting in the effort.
It's the
times when they try to force him the ball when he's not really engaged that there's sort of trouble and he's fumbled passes.
There are times when I can see it now. I've watched enough of him play where I can see good DeAndre from bad DeAndre at one glance. And the bad DeAndre rolls into a lane and almost half-heartedly puts up his arm for the ball. Like he doesn't want it. He doesn't want the ball thrown to you, and you can tell. And you can tell the times, and he'll grab a pass and hit the ball with his left hand after catching it with one hand. You're like, whoa, okay, he's got some edge tonight. And I don't know whether in college it was a matter of him never feeling uncomfortable playing the position he did at Arizona and playing against college kids. Clearly, he's had issues.
He played power forward in college also.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he got to linger around the perimeter and face the basket and follow shots and do that kind of stuff. But here in the NBA, you're going up against very strong physical men, and he don't like that a ton.
There's going to be a band called Good DeAndre, Bad DeAndre in like 5 years, and we're all going to be like, oh, you guys lived in Phoenix back in 2020, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
You're definitely from Phoenix.
Yeah, you guys, yeah.
Because it really is. It's like you guys are saying. I mean, when he was at U of A, I just looked at him as, okay, this is a guy that played really well against ASU. He puts up really good numbers. I get why he's in the discussion for the number one pick. The only reason I didn't want the Suns to take him number one overall is because I didn't think you needed to use the top pick on a big man. I don't think the NBA at this point, you have to have a big man. But when he's on your team, you see exactly what Jared's saying of like, it's frustrating because you see how good he can be, but then you don't see it consistently. It'd be easier if he was just terrible.
And this, we don't need, the Suns don't need him to be dominant for them to do really well. Obviously, they're doing really well this season. But you could just see it in that game, in that Lakers game. The Lakers were giving them a game that first half. An undermanned, completely less talented Lakers team was giving them a game. In the second half, when DeAndre Ayton started to play much better and started to take over, the Suns pulled away.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not a coincidence.
This is the thing that when I'm watching basketball all weekend and you see the energy exchange when players do something physical or aggressive or finish at the rim or finish strong and what it does to the team. It's so profound that I don't understand why anybody argues that point, that the not dunking, the laying the ball up, it's not natural for basketball players who make it to the NBA.
Yeah, I think that we're hitting this like zone right now where, you know, people have dug their heels in on either side of the argument with DeAndre, and they're not going to be swayed until something happens consistently one way or the other. And we're in this, like, I don't want to call it a lull, but I don't think we're going to really find out much more about him until the playoffs. Unless he just goes on an absolute tear here, but I mean,
and here's the other thing.
That's going to change till the playoffs at this point.
It's the argument has also gotten sort of cloudy because it was much easier when he was frustrating and the team sucked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because then you just
there's a direct
angry
correlation.
Yeah.
This year, when he's up and down, great sometimes, frustrating sometimes, the team has been almost consistently very good the whole year. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. Whenever we talk about DeAndre Ayton, it's hard for it to not look like we're just picking on him, which we're not. But, you know, people, Suns fans will say, like, they always get after Dan. It's like, oh, all you want to do is complain about DeAndre Ayton and the team's winning. Well, it's two different things.
Two different things. And because the winning now versus winning later, it's going to get more and more and more difficult. It's going to get more and more physical. There are times when DeAndre seems to fatigue mentally more than physically, but I don't think his conditioning is great. But again, I think this is going to test him. It's going to test his will to get in there, and this is why he's going to have to be razor sharp when that time comes.
Let me just play one more. This is about how much CP3 has helped him this year.
On and off the court, I could say, you know, he's always on me. He's a guy who's pays attention to detail a lot. And, you know, most of the times you see the things that you can't see, you know, and it can help us long in the long run. And, you know, just being prepared, having that playoff mindset and, you know, knowing teams' tendencies and knowing their bread and butter, just knowing what teams want, knowing their best players, getting the ball out their hands, just being the type of player, he put this pressure on me to where knowing that he gave me the key to be the anchor of the defense where whatever I say goes, and, you know, just being on top of that and, you know, having your teammates look out for you and stuff. It's just he give you a sense of awareness and urgency.
I feel like there, because I absolutely feel like DeAndre Ayton genuinely wants to be the guy everybody wants him to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there are times when Chris Paul's like watching film with him and he's like, now look at this. Look at what you did right here. And Ayton's just like watching it and having fun and being like, no. DeAndre, that's you doing that. You could do that every time.
Right.
Like, I just feel like he just enjoys this. He's along for the ride and he wants to be better, but I think sometimes he forgets how good he is.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. You look at Devin Booker, and Devin Booker is clearly a guy that is a great team guy. He's proven that, but you can tell the ambition and the edge. He's going places, and no one's going to stop Devin Booker. He's made that very, very clear. That's exactly everything DA isn't. DA has just been a guy who's never had to fight for anything in basketball prior to now, prior to coming to the NBA. Always got as many minutes as he could play, given his size and his fluidity. And so that's his mindset. It's not the same thing as other players who carved out a dream to make it to the NBA with an unquenchable fire that burns inside of them. And if you even stand near guys like that, you're going to get burned. That's the story of guys like Kobe Bryant and Devin Booker and Michael Jordan. You even stand near them, you get scorched by their intensity. And it's everything that DeAndre's got to do. One last thing on this. I thought Eddie Johnson, who's always brilliant in his analysis of the Suns, he was talking about playing with bigs who had trouble catching the basketball. And he said during the broadcast last night, the one tactic we would do as a basketball team, we'd start firing passes at the dude's head. You'd catch him then.
It's a different time.
Yeah, right. But you catch him then. You learn to catch the basketball when you're getting hit in the face with it if you don't catch
it. That is true, but now we're in an era where you can't even throw the ball to the ref. So it's everything has come full circle here.
Right.
Yeah. We'll see. It's all going to come together in the playoffs. We're going to have some sort of resolution for sure. Baseball season's here, and we're getting you ready for the home opener with the Arizona Sports Valley Virtual Series presented by 72 Sold. Get your price. Text OPENER to 620-620 to receive a link to this secret event, where you'll hear from your favorite Arizona sports host. You might even win prizes like jerseys, hats, more. Just text OPENER to 620-620. All right, so the NFL draft was supposed to be in Vegas last year, and now it's in Cleveland. So I guess we're easing back into the era of having live drafts.
Cleveland isn't even the Vegas of Ohio.
Yeah, it's
well, what would be, Jarrett? I think it would be. I think it would be.
Maybe Columbus.
Okay.
I guess you've never been to Toledo on a Saturday night.
Yeah, so
I've been to Youngstown once. They wouldn't let us stay in a hotel because there was a wedding and everything was booked.
Wow.
For one wedding. We had nowhere to stay. It was like downpour. Yeah. Anyway, carry on.
The thing about the draft is it's kind of funny because last year's draft, the quaint stay-at-home quarantine NFL draft, it played out to rave reviews. And the league acknowledged that, right? But the league wants this a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
They want 500,000 people over 3 days invading a city, walking around, beers in their hands. They're wearing their jerseys. They love that look. That is such a flex for the league. To say, look what we can bring to a city.
Well, it's either that or Roger Goodell in his pajamas slowly sliding off his recliner each round, like getting closer and closer to the floor.
Is that what happened? Yeah, that's right. That's kind of what happened.
Yeah.
That was fun, though.
It was.
It was fun.
It wouldn't be fun every year.
That's what I was going to say. Maybe it was only fun the one because it was the first, even though it's not an actual sporting event, it was the first sports thing during the pandemic. It was about a month into it when all we had was, you know, Tiger King and The Last Dance. And this was the first, even though it was weird, it was the first sense of normalcy. But it also, the interesting thing is you said, like, that wouldn't be good every year. There's nothing different that happened. There was still the same number of busts, still the same number of great picks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, quarterbacks went early. It's like nothing really changed when they had all these tremendous changes about scouting and about, you know, everyone couldn't be in the war room. Nothing really changed. Mm-hmm. It just showed how unnecessary all this stuff is, really.
That is true. All the GMs, remember the GMs were like, oh, we can't do the draft if we're not all going to be able to go to our team headquarters? Like,
yeah,
did.
I know.
It was fine.
Well, listen, Ed, if there's a good thing that came out of the pandemic as it relates to the NFL is I think it really kind of exposed some of these myths and frauds in the NFL about how much prep time is needed, how much control over players, how much you need them to be in front of you, practicing, working, voluntary, mini camps, training camps, all that stuff. They took the field in week one and played incredibly high levels of football. They did all of that without any preseason football.
You would not have known.
You wouldn't.
If you didn't know.
Nope.
That anything was different once the season started.
And you know what it is? I'll tell you very, very frankly what it is. There's the people that run the sport of football, the coaches, the GMs, the scouts, all the people that are in charge in football want the dynamic to be perceived as what they do is most important. What last year proved is that football players are what makes all of this go. And the idea that football players could walk into a season with very minimal training and Zoom conference practices and visualization, I give football players all the credit in the world. That's why they're professional. It shouldn't come as a surprise that they could do all that other stuff that the league and teams and owners make them do. It's a scam.
Yeah, they're like, I understand the NFL wanting to make this a big production, and hey, this is, you know, this is part of our offseason, but we want to be a year round NFL. We want this sport to be year round. I understand all that, but when it's the GMs or the front offices or the coaches, it's like what you're saying, where there's that sense of like, we want everybody to think what we're doing is just unheard of, and nobody could ever do what we're doing. And so we need if you disrupt that, how are we going to do it? Well, we disrupted it, and we got probably the two best teams in the Super Bowl, and everything kind of played out the way.
And nobody takes themselves more seriously than NFL GMs and NFL officials.
Without
and NFL. We're so important. The coaches, I sleep at the office.
It's exactly that, and coaches don't have to do that. But they, when they do that, they kind of pad this myth that nobody can do what we are the engineers of all of this. No, you're not.
We couldn't possibly play a real game without playing four fake games first. How will we assess our personnel?
Right.
How will we get warmed up?
Right. Right. Exactly. How will we assess? I don't know. Game film from the previous year? How about that?
Does that work
for you?
Having people who've played football their entire lives
play football. Yeah. That's the thing, but it kind of and I think that was one of the revelations, that football is run by players. The coach myth in football, it is so absurdly over the top.
The preseason, like future preseasons, I mean, it's not like we didn't all know how useless it was, but now it's like, all right, come on, Nick, now we've seen how useless it is. Do we really have to, are we going to keep doing this?
Right. Right.
Now it's just like such an obvious charade.
Yeah. How much coaching did the Super Bowl champion from last year really do last year? Not a ton.
That's the real, I mean, that really drives the point home. This is a team that was working in a new quarterback and a bunch of new other pieces. I mean, Tampa Bay was put together like they were almost like a super team. They were like the NFL's version of a super team. And without a preseason, they won the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So... You're crazy. Telling me Jacksonville can't get ready for the year?
Yeah, it's those in power, that's, they want to remain in power and they want to keep their share of power. And how do you do that? Because we need all this.
All right. So what do you think of Lake Erie versus the Bellagio fountain? Because that's what we're doing this year.
The Ohio River.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, look, in these artistic renderings that aren't real, they make it look kind of interesting.
But they're not real.
I mean, the exciting thing is if they're going to have it in Cleveland, that means that they could probably have it in Glendale or Phoenix eventually.
Yeah.
No, they can't. You're missing the entire point of what they're doing. They're doing this in cities with a lot of surrounding cities to bring in a huge swath of football fans. You do it here, you might get people from California coming here. Some people will fly here. You want to make it so football fans can get in their car and drive to that city. And that way you have this huge crowd. So
I mean, personally,
I don't think you're going to see it out here.
I mean, I'd rather go 10,000 miles to Phoenix than, you know, down the street to Cleveland. So.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that.
You might be right, though. I mean, they're going to play the Super Bowl in a place like Phoenix. They're not ever going to play the Super Bowl in Cleveland. So maybe this is the NFL's
way. They played it in Detroit.
Yeah, and I think
in Indianapolis.
Yeah, yeah.
In Jacksonville.
I don't think they're doing that again. I think it's just going to be in L.A. and Vegas and Phoenix and Miami. Isn't that basically the plan for the Super Bowl? They've got
the plan forever.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. Look, I'm just happy we have like a full draft back, but you're right. It didn't really change anything at the end of the day. All right, we come back. Steve Keim spoke to the media this morning. We'll get some of his insights on what exactly the Cardinals are doing, not just with Larry Fitzgerald, but at some of these other positions. That's next. It's Bickley and Murata on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station. All right, Bick, well, I'll tell you what. If you want to... ruin my excitement for baseball season. The fastest way to do it is to tell me that Zach Gallen has forearm soreness. We did that D-backs Madness show over on Saturday, and the recurring theme with every host, and certainly myself and Craig Schulte and Steve Berthume, Tom Kidd, everybody, it was, well, they got Zach Gallen. And now you hear in the update that it doesn't...
Scratched for forearm soreness, tightness, discomfort?
To pitch against Oakland today and... What was it?
Now, Lovello, I guess, said that it first started bothering him when he was swinging the bat, not necessarily when he was throwing.
All right.
That he has been getting treatment for 10 days, that he's still being evaluated, but it is something to be concerned about.
Oh, yeah, you think?
I mean, because they can't lose him.
Listen, for even the most optimistic sports fan in the Valley, you would need a 21-plus win season from Zach Gallen to be remotely involved in wild card pursuit.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
I can piece together a path where they are the second wild card in my mind, but it absolutely starts with Zach Gallen.
Right. Yeah.
Like that's it repeatedly comes back to Zach Gallen.
Yeah.
So I mean it's not, I guess, anything yet, but it's something to keep an eye on because that's the player they could least afford to lose, certainly.
Yeah, right. That's a good way of putting it.
Steve Keim talked to the media this morning, which he doesn't do all that often, and hit on a number of different topics here. So there's a few ways we can go with this. I guess we should at least start by reiterating, in case that you're just joining us now, no update on Larry Fitzgerald. Not any sort of, he said he texted with him a few times, doesn't have any more information than we do, which is sort of surprising. He did talk about J.J. Watt and A.J. Green joining the Cardinals.
Yeah, I think it definitely creates a level of excitement, not only for our fan base, but for those players in particular. You know, guys become a creature of habit, and they're so used to being at one place for so long that, again, that it almost creates a little bit of enthusiasm that maybe that they wouldn't have had at another team. So I know J.J. and A.J. are both really, really excited about this opportunity, and I don't think the weather hurts.
So, perceptually, that's okay. Huge for this team.
Yeah, yes, definitely. I thought it was interesting how Steve Keim went out of his way to kind of get into the numbers on A.J. Green. He had him handy. He said of the 118 targets he had, 38 of them were uncatchable. So, how many receptions did A.J. Green have again last year? Because if you can do the math.
He was right around, I thought he was in the 40s. Let me double check. He absolutely made it a point to point out that that he was one of the best receivers in traffic in the NFL. What he
right.
had third best in the
third
NFL.
Third best in the NFL catching footballs in traffic. So he was armed with some real data because I think this is one of the lingering things that people are going to have about it.
Here's that cut on
47 for
well, it all starts with the tape. I don't think his stats are really telling a great story about the type of player he still is, in my opinion. I think he was targeted 118 times. We charted it. I think it was 38 balls that were uncatchable, you know, to our scouts and to our coaching staff. So he's still got a lot left in the tank, in my opinion. Runs great routes, really strong in traffic. I think he was the third best receiver in the NFL this past year with catching balls in traffic. And really strong hands, still has the vertical speed, runs crisp routes. And as a guy with great character, and that was something that we looked to in free agency this year when we added players, regardless of position, guys with great character and leadership skills.
Well, see, the thing about if he's right that he still has the vertical speed, then everything else will fall into place with A.J. Green.
Character.
Great character. Because they've got technology now where you can watch game film. They've got GPS apps that give you miles per hour of everybody on the field and every action they take. So you can sit here and say, okay, 118 targets, 38 uncatchable balls. Do the math. That would mean 80 of the targets were catchable. And he had 40-something catches?
47 receptions.
47? Is 47 out of 80?
No, I was going to say, that's still not too good.
That's not great, is it?
Well, actually, if you look at ESPN, they said he had 104 targets. So actually, Kai may have undersold it right there.
Okay. So that makes the numbers look a little bit better.
That's like 47 out of 66. That's a lot better.
Yeah. Okay, that is better. When I look at this, I think the net effect of this offseason, clearly the jury is out on whether or not J.J. Watt and A.J. Green are going to be worth the money, particularly J.J. because he got a premium contract. But what the beauty of it is this is going to get the Cardinals through this long offseason in a much better place. Where we were at with this football team 2 weeks ago was in a much different place. That and not to repeat myself, but the last two games of the regular season were so damning and so alarming and so utterly disgusting with what was on the table that it's a real good job by Steve Keim to put together something that has got the focus diverted. They
change the narrative.
Change the narrative.
You're stopped thinking about the disappointing end of the season, and you got you excited again for the start of next season.
That's the brilliance of this, and that's not going to change. That's not going to change even if Larry Fitzgerald retires.
That is the brilliance of it. I mean, look, the 2018 season, when it ended, remember, we were all just like, I never want to think about this season again. And the Cardinals were on the same page. Last year, we were going through the season. We're like, okay, this is progress. Like, this team is doing what they were supposed to do. And then the last 2 weeks, it was like, I never want to think about John Wolford again.
Right.
So I agree that Steve Keim has done just a masterful job of putting that. It feels like it was years ago. That's not really his job, though, is it? I mean, his job is to make sure when the season's going next year, this team is winning 10, 11 games.
Yes. And to me, again, the idea of physicality and leadership, I think both were lacking on this football team last year. Steve Keim is the one that got us into that boat.
Yeah. And he brought that up today.
Right. So I give him props for really addressing that. But I also think that if you look at this objectively, the whole key to this, all of it's going to be, is if Kyler Murray takes a quantum leap this year in year three, he's going to take everyone along for the ride and everything will be worthwhile. Even all the aggravations, all of it will be more than worthwhile. So how do you get there? You've got to make him feel better about standing in the pocket, reading the field. You've got to make him feel better about not getting hit. And so you had to build from the inside out. And I think with the offensive line that they've done, for those who have not heard, they announced the signing of Brian Winters, who will likely play left guard. Right? No, he's going to play right guard.
It sounds like they're going to keep Pugh at left guard.
Well, and that's the other thing that I think he said this morning that was of note to me, that Justin Pugh is still looking to be the team's starting left guard.
I do see Justin as our left guard, and I think he had hit one of his best seasons as a pro last year, played extremely consistent, and really excited about what he did for us on the field. The addition of Brian Winters excites me. He's a guy that I've watched for years, dating back to Kent State when he came out. A really physical player, smart, really good quickness in a short area, and I think he does a great job in pass protection. So he's a guy that certainly will have a chance to compete, and as well as signing back Max Garcia, who can play guard or center for us.
I can tell you along those lines, the quote that really stood out to me, because it shows just how fragile this offseason might have been if the Raiders didn't feel the need to get rid of Jeremy Hudson, was Keim saying flat out he didn't expect Hudson to even be available.
Well, like everybody, I saw the news that he was potentially going to be released, which shocked me because of the type of player that I saw on tape. So then when the opportunity presented itself and I talked to Mike Mayock, we tried to pull the trigger extremely quick. It was it took a matter of minutes to get the deal done. And again, really excited about what he brings to the table, not only on the field, but in the locker room as well.
Like, don't you feel a lot worse about this offseason if he didn't become available?
Oh, yeah. No, listen, that's the linchpin to it all. And I think that was an interesting bit from Steve Keim, because there was this belief that the Cardinals knew this was going to happen. So after signing J.J. Watt, they took a couple of days off while other teams were striking and Cardinal fans were wondering what's going on, and they were waiting to do this. That's not the case. He just said it. Rodney Hudson shook loose because of a weird set of circumstances, because the Raiders got wind that the Chiefs were going to sign him for $13.5 million a year.
Yeah, that's it's an amazing bargain,
right?
That they got.
Right, and then they came out and said, "Okay, you know what? That's the move that makes the offseason to me." The J.J. Watt thing was what? Or what?
Exactly.
What?
Right.
The AJ Green thing was green.
No, but I mean, that's two off seasons in a row now where there's no way they could have foreseen DeAndre Hopkins being available and Houston coming along and taking on David Johnson's contract to give you DeAndre Hopkins. And then this isn't even like anything. Everything just kind of fell into place for the Cardinals, that Hudson would be available,
right,
but then that he wouldn't hit the open market because he probably would have gone to Kansas City. So instead, the Raiders are like, no, we'd rather just trade him to you. Like, that could not have worked out any better. That's two off seasons in a row that happened for the Cardinals.
And that he became available in the one way that Steve Keim is really good at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one, you know.
Yeah, if he entered the draft.
If he was a free agent, you don't know if this Cardinals would have figured it out. If he was, you know, a draft a top draft guy. You don't know if he would have made the right pick. But when somebody becomes available, he pounces on it quickly, and he does it efficiently.
Mm-hmm. I've said this before, man. Steve Keim in the draft, sometimes he's like Shaq at the free throw line. But when it's a trade, he is Shaq dunking. He's Shaq like ripping the backboard off the...
Yeah.
I mean, he is... I don't know why teams still trade with him.
No, there's no doubt about it. He's got a great ability to work on some of these lesser organizations. He's preyed on the Raiders for years. He's preyed on the Texans.
He's even preyed on the Patriots, kind of, to get Chandler Jones, which nobody does.
Wow.
And I'm sure Belichick was like, no, I had to get rid of him for this reason.
Yeah, right.
All right, when we come back, March Madness is actually, it's still going on right now, Gonzaga playing. It's in full swing, and the upsets are everywhere. That's next. It's the Bickley and Murata Show on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station.
Bickley and Murata.
All right, let's get back into March Madness here.
Yeah, why not?
Especially because the more I read about the Zach Gallen thing, the less I want to talk about anything ever again. But I won't overreact. All right.
Well, tell the listeners what did you just learn about the Zach Gallen
thing? So, Jared, where did you see that quote? Zach Gallen apparently spoke, and I'm paraphrasing a paraphrase, but that he only feels the forearm discomfort when he swings a bat. Okay, well, you know, I guess pinch hit for him, or just I don't even know how that would work if it was just that. But there's more. Or throws his curveball.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of whip in the arm action on that. A lot of spin required. That doesn't sound like a good.
I feel like he
anecdote.
Needs his curveball.
Yeah, yeah.
This is from Steve Gilbert that says that Zach Gallen says only pitch where he felt the forearm issue was with the curveball. Other pitches are fine. Velocity is fine. Felt it happen the first time when in the batting cage and was jammed with a pitch.
Okay. Huh.
Okay.
All right. So I mean, like I said, it's not anything yet.
No.
And hopefully it doesn't become anything.
But there's always a path to these stories, and they all start out like this.
The forearm
tightness, soreness, can't break off a curveball.
So did
get a second opinion, no results, no news, and then wham.
Did he get hit with a pitch? Is that what they're saying?
Jammed.
Okay.
Jammed.
So you don't know what it means.
Not jellied.
Okay.
Well, you know what it means when you get jammed by a pitch.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, if he got hit, or I guess...
He didn't get hit. It sounds like, you know, it's...
He had to move.
You got jammed. You hit the ball really low on the barrel, and then you get the handful of bees, the stingers.
So, in a way, isn't that good? That's better than, he was throwing a pitch, and all of a sudden, his forearm hurt.
Yes.
I mean, you're right, because every time, it feels like we hear, this pitcher was throwing, and then he had forearm discomfort as he was pitching. I'm sure he'll be fine, and then he misses a year and a half. It doesn't sound like that's exactly what this is.
Yeah.
So,
that's right.
Good.
So let's hope.
All right. Back to March Madness. Gonzaga playing right now.
Gonzaga playing the Pac-12 unbeaten Oregon taking down Iowa today. What a stunning rebuke from the Pac-12. As I said earlier, unbeaten the NCAA tournament after Larry Scott was fired. That's all it took.
They should have done this
that's
a while ago.
That's all it took. That's right. Should have done it a while ago.
I don't know the record of the Big Ten, but it's got to be like the exact opposite of the Pac-12.
Yeah, it can't be very good.
I mean, who's even left from the Big Ten? Michigan.
Michigan's left from
Maryland.
The Big Ten. Maryland. Yeah, because everyone thinks of the Big Ten when you think of Maryland.
I forgot the Big Ten expanded.
Are you a Terrapin fan?
Oh, yeah.
Are you?
My first favorite team. I watched the game with Jackie the Jet this weekend.
Did you?
I did. It was now a luxury I'm afforded to that he has moved to Arizona.
And you didn't get your hair cut like you said you were going to.
I did it, but I will soon.
Uh-huh.
It's funny because my dad, he moved here, but he doesn't have a house yet. So he's in one of a long-term hotel.
Because it's a great time to come here and go house shopping.
I know. Yeah. So he's watching the game and he's screaming profanities. I'm like, Dad, you're not at home right now. They're going to throw you out of the hotel. You're going to be living with me again. And,
that's funny. It's like an episode of Seinfeld.
So Jim Boeheim, by the way, so far gets the quote of the tournament. He was asked about prognosticators and how is it that, you know, you guys as a basketball team always make it to the Sweet 16 when you have no expectations. His quote was, quote, "Not one sentence on the internet matters. Not one," end quote.
I'm trying to think. He might be right.
Certainly describes Twitter.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Not one sentence on social media matters.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who are Fighting Illini fans who think their team was done dirty. That as a number one seed, they'd won 14 of their last 15 games. And the committee, for the sake of TV interests and local interest, slotted Loyola in eighth seed, who was they were underseeded at eight, to create a good television matchup. And just like that, boom, they're gone.
Yeah,
that was one of the stories. That game seemed to really pop because I think you're right. The way Loyola won that game with Sister Jean up there. With that Cameron Crutwig kid with the mustache, the kind of player you never see in the NBA. It was just a scene that seemed to be very unique or unique to college basketball.
That's true. It's absolutely. Look, I mean, the closest we ever got to that, remember Adam Morrison went to the NBA and he had his crazy mustache and he lasted like 2.5 years. So it's been proven.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Nothing like the image of him crying at midcourt as tears stream down his wispy mustache.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
It feels like foreshadowing for mustache, not a mustache.
All right. So somebody had a good line about it. They said, "This march isn't mad. It's completely lost its mind." And that's kind of a good synopsis of what we saw over the weekend. I was riveted by it, and I'll be honest with you, as a kid who grew up just adoring college basketball, I went into this thing with very little interest that was partially born from not having a tournament in a couple of years, in having such terribly low expectations for this tournament, which came to light when VCU had a tap out because of COVID concerns.
Yeah, that was my biggest thing.
That is
my biggest thing going into the tournament was like, you know, you have the week leading up and everybody's filling out brackets and just in the back of your mind, you're like, okay, but like, what if this is the one sporting event still where you're kind of like, oh, what if this doesn't happen? What if an entire region just, you know, four or five teams are missing games? And it seems like that's not going to be the case other than VCU, like you said, which was
right.
What if Gonzaga is the only really top seed that it keeps advancing? And then when they get to the Final Four, they get kicked out because of COVID.
Oh, man.
And it's Oral Roberts versus Loyola.
If Gonzaga is ever going to win, this is the year, right? They're undefeated.
This is the year.
They're supposed to be amazing, and everybody else is out.
Yes, yes, that's exactly true. The I look at this, so I came out of this weekend with a reminder that college basketball during the NCAA tournament is very important. It's very gratifying to me. To people who love basketball, it gives you something the NBA doesn't have. It gives you unpredictability.
Doesn't it also make you think, why can't college football get it right?
Yes.
Because if college, I mean, they're run by the same people in theory, but if it was run the way college football is run, they would have just voted Illinois into the Final Four, and then there never would have been a game, and they would have voted Michigan and all these other teams.
Yes.
So
yes,
just take all the fun out of it and tell us who you want to see in the championship. That's what it would be.
That's the fundamental issue with college football is it's a cabal now. It's rigged. It's rigged to suit the benefits of a handful of programs at the very, very top. This is a reminder of the majesty of college athletics, not college basketball, the sport, and certainly not one and dones. Like you look at what ASU just did in their disappointing season, and you have to believe they're questioning this methodology. Do we want to go down this road again? Because when you bring in one and dones, you bring in kids with expectations, you bring in kids who have support systems and street agents and voices, and they disrupt your program is what they do. And you can have a guy who's been in the program for a couple of years, and he's coached, and he's gotten better, and he's developed, and he's been coachable. And then when it's his time to shine, here comes some young dude who's going to be in school 4 months and now he's a starter and he takes your job. It can have a tremendously bad effect on everything if you don't get the right one and doners. And at a school like ASU, you would think that there are some colleges you would want to go to and just tap out as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Right? Like going to school in Tucson, for instance.
Okay. Thanks, Vince. Thanks, Vince Jr.
Sorry, buddy. I did that just to prod you. But ASU is a school, a lot of kids go there and really love their experience.
Yeah.
So I would think that if you were going to build something, doing a four-year paradigm, I think it'd be a better way to go at ASU. You'd have to be asking these questions.
It's so hard, though, because the year where they had their two best, like, recruitment, you know, the two best recruits, the two best freshmen ever, was also the weirdest college basketball year ever.
Yeah, and it just went so
horribly
wrong.
I don't know if you could learn anything from this
year. Yeah, maybe you can't. Maybe you can't. And maybe you just let Bobby Hurley keep doing what he does, because he does recruit extremely well.
Well, along those lines, I don't know that you have a choice. Like, if you can get guys that are good enough to be one and done, you sort of have to do it, and you have to play to your strength. And, you know, Bobby Hurley's strength so far has clearly been recruiting over in-game coaching, right? I mean, I think we'd all agree
he's
a better
that.
So I don't know that they have an option to go away from it, but it just it failed so horribly this year. And now you have guys, to your point, Pick, that have been here that are all leaving too.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like that weren't supposed to leave. So who knows? All right, coming up, we'll get back into Steve Keim's comments, the NFL. We got a lot here cramming into the final hour of the show. It's the Bickley and Murata Show on 98.7
FM. Social studies next too.
Oh, social studies is next. I forgot it was 1 o'clock on 98.7 FM.
Flies.
Arizona's sports station.